Martin Keaveney, Creative Writing. Creative Writing, Introduction by Remote. Week 6. Presented by Martin Keaveney.
Good evening, and you're all very welcome to Week 6 of your Creative Writing Introduction Remote course. This is an audio recording of the tutorial section of the course, prepared for those of you who cannot attend the live video conference, and perhaps some of you would like to hear the tutorial again. You'll have already received an email containing the PowerPoint presentation, which contains all of the slides that I'll be discussing over the next hour or so. So what I'd like you to do now is check your email if you haven't already done so, and download the file named Week 6 that I've sent you. You can pause the audio while you're doing this if you like. Okay, so you should now be looking at the first slide of the presentation. You'll see the date and the title, The World of Shadows, and a rather peculiar looking figure. Now, before I go into the presentation, I'm just going to recap on where we are in this course, just for anyone that has been attending a video conference or missed a class here and there, etc., and hasn't been at the mall or wasn't at the classes in previous weeks. So we started the course with the course outline, an introduction to poetry, and indeed you all wrote some nice poetry. Week 2 was spent discussing approaches to writing, how to get started, setting up your writing location, and even your writing method, such as by hand or using a laptop or even dictaphone. We also discussed realism and writing in the realist form. Then, in week 3, we engaged with the topic of what it is to be a writer, looking at various ways we can help ourselves sustain our writing practice in the long term, thinking of ourselves as writers in the community, if you remember. That week we also looked at the science fiction genre, had a reading, and also read some of your pieces in the workshop, which were written in the realist form. Week then was focused on the genre of crime, where we wrote about characters that break the law, and we looked at a piece of crime fiction. We also looked at the craft area of self-editing. That is revising and reworking your projects to get them to the best place they can be before others respond to them. Then in week 5, we looked at the genre of relationships, or human conflict, to be more specific, and also discussed the aspects and strategies for sharing your work. And as this is often a bartering system, we discussed techniques to help you critique other writers' work. So I hope that that gives you an overview of the course so far. It may help to refresh your memory. But if you have any questions about any aspect of the course up until now, don't hesitate to email me at info@martinkeaveney.com. Just some other housekeeping now, which I'll mention at the end as well, is that at this point, your final project, if you have decided you want to submit one, should be well underway. Remember, this is something that can be done up to 2,000 words in any of the genres we've covered in the course, including the final two to come in week 7 and week 8, which will be playwriting and screenwriting. If you do decide to write a play or a screenplay, just remember that they shouldn't be any more than 20 minutes long, but I'll talk about more about those mediums in the respective weeks. The final project should be submitted by the last class, which is now just 3 weeks away. And just to let you know that I will be getting back to you within 3 months, or probably less, with an extended editorial and also advice on how to proceed with the project. Again, if you have any questions, just send me an email on it. I'd also like you now to reflect on how your writing regime has been going since you started the course. Have you managed to start writing regularly, once a week or even daily? Do you have a place that you always write? Have you tried out a few different ways of writing?
And of course, you may, of course, already be somebody who's comfortable in your method, and that's, of course, perfectly fine. These are just some questions you can reflect on if you like. Okay, so let's get on with the class and click on to slide 2. So tonight we're looking at the genre of horror. I'll get to that later on. This should be just a brief, fairly uncomplicated introduction and discussion of the horror genre. And we will firstly be discussing the craft stage of polishing up our material and finally clicking submit, or even if anyone does that nowadays, pop it into the post box. So let's click to slide 3 and a few things to think about as we progress through the tutorial. We're talking here about late drafts. So these would be particularly for beginner writers, those you have rewritten a number of times. I would certainly suggest 4 to be a conservative or a minimum number. Of course, there is the reality that some people will start at different points in their story. And of course, that methods can change and it may not be as simple as this. But this is just a kind of a method for a beginner writer to start writing and then rewrite the work again and rewrite the work again. So that's the basis of this idea of the around the 4 drafts, where I get the number of 4, and then to type it up as a 5th draft would be the kind of method I would use at the moment. You would ideally have shown the work then to a friend or writer's group, as we discussed last week, about the challenges of finding readers, but you would certainly have shared it and received some kind of response to the work, ideally. And once you have implemented the feedback, or even ignored it if you prefer, which is fine too, by the way, then you have to look at the project and decide whether you have reached a point where you're simply changing the work instead of improving it. Indeed, it is possible that you could be making it worse and overwriting certain areas and, as they say, the old saying, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So it's something I'm often asked about, as are many writing teachers, is how do you know when the work is ready? So the novelist Will Self has suggested that those who can afford it will continue tweaking forever, and those who instead need an advance or need the payment for the story to buy food will release it far quicker. Yes, it may not seem a very artful strategy, but there may well be a grain of truth in it. However, you are probably not going to receive a large payment for a short story, yet you do want to submit it. I think it's a mixture of intuition and providence. Sometimes a deadline means you have to submit, or other times you'll feel a story is where you want it to be. You may not be happy still. That might be a good sign. Someone asked Anthony Burgess on the occasion of his 30th novel that he must be now writing the perfect work at this stage, that there could be no flaws anymore. And he disagreed with the interviewer. He said there were many flaws in his latest novel. When asked to point them out, he refused, saying he had often been complimented on aspects of his novel which he saw as flaws. So the point is here that our judgment of our work is often at best weak and regularly quite delusional. It is like asking a devout parent to note the flaws in their child. Having said that, if you practice writing long enough, you will handle the material more and more effectively. And what you see as flaws, as like Burgess after 30 novels, sees are often either missed by the reader or even seen as marks of genius. So to recap, the point of release really is the deadline or when you feel you are actually making it worse. It is, of course, important to keep copies of each draft, as you will find sometimes you have taken a wrong turn and maybe need to go back a few steps. If you've only got one version, you will have to rewrite, and that, I suppose, is not always a bad thing. But it is good to keep copies. Now, when do you say, okay, it's done, we need to make sure it's in the industry format? So what is industry format? Well, I would suggest for prose, the format is the font, which is the type of text you're going to use, is Times New Roman. And the font size, which is obviously the size of the letters, is 0.12. Now, some editors and publishers might request other fonts, such as Verdana, I've seen, or Calibri. So if they suggest, if they request that, give it to them. But if in doubt, choose Times New Roman if there's no specification. There are virtually no publishers or agents today that will accept handwritten manuscripts. The vast majority of publishers and agents will also appreciate if you have the text justified. This is done by clicking on a paragraph, if you're in Microsoft Word, clicking on the paragraph tab and then adjusting the option in the alignment tab to justify it. Other systems obviously will vary. If you do this that way in Microsoft Word, you then can go to the line spacing and select double spacing. Other occasionally agents request 1.5 spacing, and rarely you'll find journals which ask for left alignment. So it's of course very important to check what way they want their submissions, and they usually have the guidelines clearly on their website or on their actual magazine. Agents have told me they receive 300 manuscripts every week. So an easy way to prune this for them is simply not reading submissions that don't specifically comply with the requirements. If an author is indifferent to an agent or publisher's submission guidelines, they may be indifferent to many other things. That is not a good way to start your business relationship with agents or publishers. Therefore, make sure your submission is as reasonably close to their requirements as possible. If they ask for 1.5 spacing, for example, Verdana and left alignment, it may not be what most people ask for, but if you want to get published or represented by that particular industry professional, then you need to give them that. Give your material a good chance. It only takes a few clicks. It's not like you have to rewrite the whole thing to get it into the format that they want. It's just a few clicks. So take notice of that. Okay, let's move on now to slide 4. So once you have it finally written and you have it completely prepared in terms of fonts and sizes and that, what is actually the market you will be submitting your piece into? Well, it depends on the work you're submitting. Is it a book, a short story, or a collection of poetry? Obviously, the type of thing you are publishing determines where you are sending it. There is little point sending your novel, Mr. Bear Goes to the Circus, to a blood and torture magazine. Make sure that the magazine publishes your type of work. How do you know what type your work is? Well, hopefully you have a good idea now at this point in the course. Science fiction we covered, and crime, horror. Science fiction is in great demand, and so is crime and horror. Literary fiction is, on the other hand, difficult to publish. As a beginner, you might like to publish short pieces in online magazines, but there isn't any need to just simply send it anywhere. A writer like you that has invested in this course is committed enough to try and find a good home for your work. I've often said magazines that are established at least 10 years and publish quarterly are certainly serious about publishing and probably have a high standard of work in their pages. It's not to say that new or annual magazines cannot be of high quality. Of course they can, and they are. But many new magazines often do need to fill their pages and may not be as discerning as older magazines. They also haven't got an established readership. So it is quite difficult to get published in these longer term magazines. And if you do place something there, it really does demonstrate your quality as a writer, which is useful when you are going on to submit a novel manuscript or a larger collection of stories to an agent or a publisher. There is nothing wrong with online magazines, as that often means agents can easily read your published work. They don't have to buy a copy. But I would like to aim for a mix of print and online when I'm starting out publishing short pieces. It is nice, of course, much nicer to get a hard copy journal in the post with your work inside. However, the good thing about online is that if there is an error, yes, it can be easily rectified normally. Still, print on demand journals also will more than likely be able to accept revisions for subsequent editions that are printed. I wouldn't worry much about revising your story after it has appeared in a magazine. The novelist Mike McCormick once said the stories that he published in magazines were simply late drafts of the version which he would later include in a collection. So they do become revised in the collections after they've been published in the magazines. You see there at the bottom of this slide now, traditional versus independent. So just wanted to talk a little bit about that. Traditional publishing means that a publisher pays you a sum of money for the right to publish your book. They pay for the prints, the design, the typesetting, the editorial costs, marketing, distribution, and they take responsibility for arranging readings and interviews. The only thing you do is interviews, is the interview themselves and the readings. Some of them may want you to engage in social media depending on the project, but you never pay anything. Once your advance that you've been paid has been given back to the publisher through the sale of your book to the general public, then you typically receive a small amount per book sold. This amount can vary. The novelist Donald Ryan has been quoted as saying 40 cents per copy for his book The Spinning Heart, while John Boyne said he sold 7 million copies of the book Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and anyone should be able to work out how much he earned from that figure. Now, if you opt for independent, which is another term for self-publishing, also known as vanity publishing, you decide yourself your work is good enough to be published. You simply hire a publisher to publish the book by paying them for everything. Publishers in this area of the industry also charge a percentage to authors who wish to self-publish. So not only do you pay them to publish the book, but they clearly are a business and they will be also charging for their services. Publishers in this area charge, and you agree an amount per copy which you receive from each copy sold. Obviously, this is usually much higher than the traditional percentage, but of course you have invested your money in this case. You need to sell quite a lot of copies to get back the costs that would be taken on by yourself. So there are a number of issues, I suppose, with independent or self-publishing. Once publishers have been paid fully for their work, the only one with any real motivation to pursue further sales is the author, as the percentages that the publisher will be getting from the onward sales will be smaller, as I've already said. So if any traditional publisher has evaluated the project and doesn't decide it is a good investment, then as authors, what qualifies us to make that judgment? We're not business people, we're artists, we're literary artists, we're writers. We're not business people, and that's not our area. So why should we be able to judge? It's not a thing that we're qualified to really make. So that is a difficulty. You can be lucky, of course. But remember the earlier metaphor about loving parents and children. And it is, of course, true that some self-published authors have become very wealthy. These are rare, relatively speaking. I would suggest that anyone that has invested in this course is definitely committed enough to ultimately produce work which will be evaluated by a traditional editor or traditional publisher as worthy of their investment. Yet, it is a decision for each writer to make. Now, let's click on to slide 5. I want to talk a little about the presentation of the work for a few moments. Do not send anything to a publisher or agent that you could have presented better. Whether something will appeal to an industry professional is like asking about the length of a piece of string. We don't have any view, we don't know what their subjective view is going to be. Because they do make subjective decisions. They publish books, they publish stories that they like, and that is something we cannot tell. But that doesn't mean we cannot present our work in the absolute best possible way. You will all have noticed my feedback by now in your work that you've sent on, often mentioning the word proofreading. What do I mean by proofreading? I mean you need to take scrupulous care in the final checks of your work. As I said, there are agents receiving 300 submissions a week. First of all, we must follow their guidelines. But another method they use to cut down on their huge workload is to dump any with sloppy presentation. Now, there are different types of presentation. The first is punctuation. What is punctuation? Punctuation is how you punctuate your work. How you use full stops, commas, semicolons, apostrophes, quotation marks, hyphens, and dashes. A regular use of these little devils tells a manuscript assessor you aren't really that serious about your work.
I don't just mean people who are aiming to do this as a career. Even if you're only writing, if you're just simply writing a memoir for your own pleasure or a biography of a local person, you owe it to the story and the subject of your story to present it in the best possible way so that your work comes through fully and you get the maximum benefit of your efforts. We abide by conventional punctuation rules. So please attend to your use of commas, apostrophes, colons, semicolons, hyphens and dashes. You can find some advice all over the internet, of course. For example, you can go to the Open Writing Lab, OWL, at Purdue University online, but there are many other places. Make sure you're getting, though, good advice and that it has been verified. There are many books out there, but this course is not big enough to give detailed training. It's not that an agent will dismiss a submission because a full stop is missing in the very first paragraph. However, it may well indicate that there will be many more of these errors in the document. Does the agent have time to ignore these errors? Is your submission that good it's not going to matter? You're asking too much of your manuscript in that way. The other aspect of proofreading is spelling and sentence structure. Check every spelling you're unsure of in the dictionary. Collins Online Dictionary is simple and fast. There are many other options. Correct spelling shows attention to detail, and that's particularly true if you're using slang or you're using localized colloquial words, to make sure that you're using the correct version. Read aloud programs, of which there are many, including one built into newer versions of Word, are also highly beneficial. So these read the text out to you, which is excellent for detecting mistakes. For example, form instead of from, which is a common slip that writers make. If it may not catch there, if you remember the mistake people often make with their house was burnt down, or they are in the house, being their house was burnt down is spelled T-H-E-I-R, and they are in the house is T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. So that's a mistake people often make, the two theirs, and its is another one. It's I-T-S or I-T apostrophe S errors. You can check out that one online, that its is a common error for writers. So those need to be picked up. This is where reading backward is a useful old publisher's trick. Start at the end of the work and read each sentence. Out of sequence of the story can help you focus on the mechanics of the language. Also, it is vital to be doubly attentive immediately after you fix an error. This is when it is natural you relax your editing eye after making a repair. But if there are two mistakes in a sentence, the other one is likely to be missed. Read Write Gold is another useful program for editors and proofreading, but all of these applications are only as good as the writer uses them. Okay, so now let's move on to slide 6. And just to note again, the publishers or editors' guidelines. So most industry outlets now take material by email. There are still some that accept posted submissions, and even a few that still insist on hard copy. So just to talk a little bit about submitting by email. If you're submitting by email, make sure that you have a generic name on your file, such as Dickens-Great Expectations or Smith-The Tale of Truth. So the author's surname first, followed by a dash, then the title of your book. That's a straightforward method of naming filling your subject heading. Sometimes the publishers want some other things in the subject heading, such as a category maybe they want to mention, such as summer reading period or some such. What is important is that you know what they want and how they want you to present it. If they don't specify, you can just simply proceed, as I said, with your surname and the title. It just looks much more professional than hello, hi, or even having no subject in the box. Also, be attentive to the type of file that you're asked to send. Many writers now use a word processor, and of course the most popular is Microsoft Office, Microsoft Word. So save the file as a doc, the newest version you can. If they want a PDF, which means permanent document format, then save the file as one of these. Sometimes they'll ask for a rich text format or RTF. Your kind of attention to these kind of requirements indicates your care with the submission of your work. If they're asking for a hard copy, write a cover letter as conventional dictates. So that's the address on the right hand, top right hand side, and their address on the left hand side. At the top of the sheet. Some even ask for a cover letter even with the electronic submission. So in this case, you should write a letter as in the conventional way. You could use a different font for the letter if you like, such as Calibri, but make sure to include an email address also on the cover letter. It's just quicker for them to get back to you if they want. They often print off those cover letters if they're asking for one. I usually place an email address on the center at the center of the bottom of the page. As I said, for the work itself, I suggest you use Times New Roman unless otherwise requested. You're better to avoid images and drawings, despite the anecdotal success of J.K. Rowling's submission that had drawings in the manuscript. It's quite rare. I would suggest you don't have drawings and you don't have images. It's just about the text itself. Also be very attentive to submission windows. Magazines with awkward times, like two different months of the year, like March or September, they might actually be more likely to be successful for you, because they probably will have less submissions rather than as opposed to magazines that will be accepting submissions all the year round. But of course that is awkward, because you have to be kind of thinking of when such X magazine is looking for submissions, what month are they looking for them. And then of course it's not simply just the first of the month, the end of the month, sometimes it's the 15th of the month, the 15th of some other month. So that is kind of a hard job, but it's just one of the tedious aspects of the submission process, is to have a kind of keep an eye on dates. So whatever way you want to do that, if you want to have a spreadsheet of all the dates, or if you just want to note them somewhere and have a calendar of them, might be a way around that. But of course, annually, most magazines will generally have the same sequence of dates. So once you get used to it, it should be okay for the following year. Okay, so now let's click on to slide 7. And I want to talk a little bit about the practice of writing a query and writing a biography. And I'm going to send you on a sample letter and biography this week as well. So you can have that to kind of refer to. It's just a suggested format. It's not like the adopted format of industry or anything. And of course, there would be some people that would argue, well, I like to show my personality through my letter, and you can do that. But I would suggest that I would keep my cover letter short. They're more interested in the text itself that you are sending them for them to read rather than your letter. What you do need to do is make sure your letter is well polished and hasn't got a typo in it, or hasn't got punctuation. And if it's fairly short, that shouldn't take long to do. It's very important that the letter is very correctly formatted and isn't incorrectly punctuated or something, because that just doesn't indicate care on the writer. The way you address the editor or agent is an art in itself, I suppose. Dear Sir, Madam is not really acceptable anymore. Dear Mary Smith, or Dear John Jones is better, or Dear Editor, or Dear Agent, or even Dear Publisher is okay. You're probably better off to avoid prefixes, because they could be, you know, interpreted in any number of ways, and you don't really want to go down any kind of avenue that might not favour your submission unnecessarily. So try to get the name of the person if you can, who you're writing to. But if you can't get the name of the person, or if they say somebody will read it in their submission guidelines, then obviously all you can do is write publisher, or write agency, or agent, or even receiver. Dear receiver is also fine. As I said, keep the letter short. If they see a large block of text, they probably won't have the time to read it. They will just quickly try to ascertain what it is you want, what it is you're sending them. So there's not much point labouring over a 2,000-word cover letter. Keep it brief. Why you write, or what you attach or close, why you are sending, I mean, why you are writing to them. I am writing to you because I want you to consider my novel in less words than that. And what you attach or enclose. I conclude without any great ceremony. Regards, kind regards, best wishes is sort of convention now. The yours sincerely is more of a letter thing. I don't think I've ever seen it in an email. I would then include my biography underneath, and you can refer to the fact that you have a biography in the email body. See my biography below, or see my brief biography below. And if it's an e-sub, then it's a good idea to include links to anything that you might have online. So if you have a website, if you have a business Facebook page, or even a business Twitter, not personal pages, but business pages, pages that are specifically for your work, then definitely, by all means, you can include that if you think it's relevant. If you don't have anything else, just if you have a lot of things, then just include those that are most relevant to the project that you're submitting. So if you're submitting screenplays, obviously you include something about your screen work. If you're submitting poetry, then it'd be poetry that you would include. I write in different mediums, so I have this. I have different biographies for different submissions. It isn't a problem, of course. Make sure as well, if you are doing that, if you're putting a link into a short story online somewhere, make sure it is your best work. And I'm sure it will be, but just to make sure that you're choosing a work that's really strong and is going to really demonstrate the quality of your practice. It isn't a problem if you haven't ever published anything before. That's not an issue. The agent is and publisher are looking for quality work. Your record as a writer is not as important. But having said that, do include anything major if you have anything major in your biography. Okay, so clicking on now to slide 8. Yes, the industry is an industry. If it is there to make a profit, people are involved in it to make money. They like books. They want to make money out of their interest and their enjoyment of books. And it is a business enterprise, like any business. It's there to sell a product at a greater price than it costs to make the product. And you're just really supplying that product. You're just one of the suppliers. You may be one of the main suppliers. But not the only person involved in the production of that book. As we have already gone through in this course, very high selling genres are crime, sci-fi, and horror. And it's useful in a course like this to look at these genres and try practicing writing in these genres to see whether you can write them, or whether you enjoy writing in them, or whether you might like to, because obviously. Obviously, those are not the only ones. Children's books, non-fiction are some of the others that are very, very good for supporting publishers in their enterprises in publishing less commercial. So publishers can publish less commercial work because they sell so many copies of these high-selling titles. Literary fiction presses will often speculate on books which rely more, and literary fiction is books or texts that rely more on the quality of their language rather than the basic plot line. And that's often a product that can win major prizes. Obviously, if you win the Booker Prize, you're going to sell a lot of more copies of your book. This is one of the ways the general reading public gauge quality, whether that is accurate or not. Okay, so many authors or writers also wonder about the area of social media now. I mean, 20 years ago, it wasn't an issue at all. It wasn't there. Now it's very ubiquitous. It's really, if you don't have a social presence, and I mean, you're you're of the very younger generation now, they'd be wondering why you haven't got one, because I think everyone coming up now, people 20 years older or younger, all are involved in having a social media presence, and so it's going to be more and more powerful. Yet there's still a good generation there of people who don't have anything to do with, or very little to do with, social media or websites. I mean, website is very fairly inexpensive nowadays. I mean, 10-15 years ago it wasn't inexpensive. Now it is very inexpensive. You can basically set one up for a very small amount of money, and obviously social media platforms are free, although they may demand a lot of your precious writing time. And it just depends really on the aims you have as a writer, what you're aiming to get out of becoming of as a writer, whether or not you need to engage it. If you're somebody who does a lot of spoken word poetry, then videos on YouTube might be a good way to promote yourself as a poet. If you're somebody that writes really long historical fiction and it's very, very long readerly text, then it may not be putting up pictures of things online might not be the best outlet for it, although there is probably a way of using it for that too. So it's something that can be used to your advantage, and I don't think it's any harm to have for a writer to have some kind of online presence, even if it's just a Twitter account. But you do have to, it's kind of something that we've all had to kind of, my generation has had to adopt to, because it's something that's there. But I think it's still evolving as well, social media, and I think it's changing a lot, and people are more aware now of how kind of how open everything is, and that's obviously going to have an effect on the way people kind of curate what they post, because for the first maybe 10 or 15 years of social media, people have been just putting everything up, and I think I would guess I could be wrong, but I suggest that the next number of years that social media is going to be less gung-ho, and people will become a lot more kind of curated about what they actually will put up online. And it's like any kind of new invention when it comes first, like the motor car or that, the people, there weren't the laws, there weren't the rules, there weren't the regulations back then, and now there are more regulations and more rules. So whether there's going to be more regulations or whether people just naturally start being less, more restrictive in their placing of material online, I think it's going to evolve further. So at the moment, I think it's no harm to have some kind of online presence, but I wouldn't allow it to encroach too much on my writing time. Okay, let's click now to slide 9. So you've sent off your story, your poem, your novel sample, and unfortunately they've sent you a polite rejection, a week, a month, or 6 months, or even much longer later. Yes, it is disappointing. You've put a lot of work into it. You've spent possibly weeks, months, even years, and maybe you haven't shown it to anyone or very few people, and you're expecting it to be published within a few weeks, and they actually write back and say it's not something we're interested in right now. So I mean, if you get a number of rejections, which most writers have, very few writers haven't got rejections, you do become somewhat insulated from them. I mean, you become kind of less kind of offended and less kind of hurt, and just realize that it's just when you have your own magazine and you're an editor, you can choose whatever you want to publish, and you really, I mean, unfortunately it is quite subjective, so they will publish what they like publishing rather than, as I have kind of been talking about for this course, whether you've handled the material or not. But if you can't really blame them, because they have spent maybe 10 years running that magazine, and they've put a lot of time and effort, and maybe not even making any money at all out of it. So they can do that. They can decide that they don't want to publish your poem or your short story. And it is very disappointing. But the good thing is you haven't lost anything. You still have the draft. You still can continue to submit it, or you can revise it and send it off somewhere else. And if you do get feedback on it, that's great. But realistically, most industry outlets don't offer any feedback, at least not for free. Occasionally, an agent will comment on something, but be wary, this can be simply a throwaway comment to soften the blow, so don't read too much into it. On the other, because that can be, well, the agent said it was this, so that means I must change the whole thing. No, the comments have to be kind of considered in their context. But on the other hand, you may get really insightful industry level responses, and that's what you want. You know, if you can get, you know, what an industry person thinks of your work, it is still useful, can be valuable, depending on how they put it. And if you're a reader and a writer, you'll be able to sift through something that's simply just softening the blow, as opposed to something that's actually, you know, constructive criticism and really helpful, really useful. And that's what you do want. So when an industry person thinks of your work, and after all, they're working in the texts day after day. They're in that area, so it really is the best you can get. It is important to develop as well, of course, a register for publications. As I've said, send the work to the places that they publish your type of work. That way, you can avoid unnecessary rejection. There will be enough rejections without unnecessary disappointments. Okay, so that leads me on to slide 10. Yes, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You will publish something somewhere sooner than you think, if that is what you want to do. I mean, some writers do my course and they don't want to publish anything. They're not interested in publication. But this is obviously about publishing. So if you are somebody who wants to publish something, there are enough editors out there that one of them is going to see what it is you're working at and will want to put it into their magazine. If you have practiced your craft, as suggested throughout the course, you ultimately will get something in print or online. That's when things get even more complicated. Proofs are what the editor or publisher may send you when they have the magazine typeset as it is going to look when it's published. If it's a story, you probably will just get that section. Obviously, you get the full manuscript novel of your work, and this is likely to be the last chance you'll get to make any changes. Once the novel goes to full print, that's it. Obviously, with online magazine stories, which has happened to me recently, you know, you can alter them if the editor is willing to do that. I mean, some online editors don't like to be adjusting things once they've published them. But I did have the opportunity to change a part of my story, one or two lines in a recent publication. So it is once it's online, you can do that. And even with print on demand publications, you can also make an adjustment as well. But if it's obviously if they print 5,000 copies, you can't change anything. And whether you do get proofs really depends on the magazine, but you'll always get them for a novel or a collection of stories. So what next when the book is published? Well, the publisher knows the business of promotion much better than writers do. So let them decide. There will be launches, there will be readings, there will be, you know, ham sandwiches, whatever they decide is the best way of doing it, reviews. We are concentrating on the product. It's their role to figure out how to sell it. You may have to do interviews, readings, or book signings. And these are all fun things, although some writers do find them very difficult. If you're doing a reading, I would say just to make sure to practice several times and give your work the best airing. So that's the end of the craft section of tonight's tutorial on publishing. And now, on slide 11, we'll move on to the horror genre.
Now, even though it's not on your slides, I'm going to shock you with a writing exercise. So I hope that you have your pen and paper ready beside you. So let's spend 5 minutes writing. You can obviously pause this audio in a moment, but just before you do, spend the next 5 minutes writing about a threat you once experienced. So don't think about it too much. The threat can be imagined or real. So get writing for the next 5 minutes and then restart the file. Good luck. Okay, good work. So I hope you I hope you got some good material to work with there. Now, let's talk about the horror genre. What is horror? So many people think horror is a scary story, and that's a fair stab at it. But I like to, as I have done throughout this course, to keep things quite broad and not force any definitions on you. So I merely describe a horror story as one where there is a threat. That threat may be imagined or real. It might be a person, place, or a thing. It might even be the narrator itself. On this slide and the next, we have, as you can see there on slide 11, we're on, you can see some quotes there from an academic article by Randy Dixon about horror. So just basically to paraphrase what Dixon is saying here, he is talking about the agitation of the reader, which is kind of the process which we are presumably trying to encourage when we write horror. Dixon uses the example of a monster, which he says is, he describes as something not known within reigning science and must produce disgust. So if we click on then to slide 12, we can see Dixon continue that the main character typically suspects the presence of something unnatural or threatening, and often spends a good part of the story attempting to discover what that thing is. So Hitchcock has often been quoted as arguing it was better to keep the threat hidden for as long as possible, and preferably forever. And apologies if you haven't seen Psycho, but if you do think of that film and the book, which Hitchcock adapted from with very little of alteration, apart from the obvious cinematic devices that he used, but the plot stays quite it's very close to the plot. You could argue that Norman Bates appears quite early in that story, but of course the mother, whose appearance is quite shocking later on, is she perhaps the real threat? So apologies if you haven't seen it. Dixon continues that we are engaged in horror for a combination of what he calls awe and curiosity about unnatural and repulsive things. So there is also, as there is with other stories, interest piqued through the structure of the narration that is constructed by the horror writer, as in the questions which the reader is asking themselves early on. For example, what is the knocking on the wall? Who is the figure behind the curtain or in the wardrobe, etc.? Dixon says that it is common practice of reading to find out what is going to happen next, which is a pure characteristic of the genre fictions, particularly horror, crime, and to a lesser extent science fiction, because science fiction is also quite reliant on the world that it inhabits. Yes, so he asks, will the character discover who the monster is? Will they be able to convince the authorities that it exists? This is horror, or art horror, to use his precise description. So it engages us with in a way that we want to know what the threat is, and is the threat going to catch the person either telling the story or as the main focus of the story. So that's a very brief chat about horror. I don't want to be too prescriptive about what horror is. Some people have a real aptitude for writing scary stories. It is probably one of the best ways to try and make a serious living out of writing. Yet it is not like turning on a tap. If you're not somebody that thinks in a way naturally, you probably would find it difficult to just write horror stories on demand, as it were. If you do want to write horror, or if you think that's something that you're drawn to write, you need to read a lot of horror books and stories. And do let me know what you thought of the yellow wallpaper. We can't obviously discuss it in this situation here, but I'd be delighted to hear what you thought of the yellow wallpaper. Send on an email on that if you like. On slide 14, then, there is some information on people who would like to do a final project. So you can see there, it's in any genre covered. It is up to 2,000 words. It can be submitted. It can be something you've already submitted and is it revising. There's no problem with that. I can give you brief one-to-one advice during classes for short pieces of advice on the work. and how you might be able to develop it. And you can then submit it and, if you like, read it in the final session. And it's also possible, which I can also facilitate, if you wanted to read out a story and you weren't able to come to the video conference, that you could read it out, record yourself reading it out, and send that on to me, and we can listen to it. We can listen to it in the workshop, in the final workshop, if you're not coming to the video conference. Okay, so just to repeat that, you can record yourself reading your story if you want, and send that to me, and I'll play it at the workshop if you're not able to come to the video conference. And if you submit this final project, I will give you feedback and advice on how to proceed via email before August, before September, I have here. And I think September will be the time, but definitely before September, I will get in touch with you, possibly before that. We are obviously in a changed situation now with the dates and times and that. But I'm aiming to be back to you before September with your final project at this point. So that's it. Next week, we are moving away from the page and to the stage, writing work to be performed rather than primarily to be read. So try to watch the play on YouTube if you don't have a DVD of it. The Rob Schaefer version is quite effective, even if the cast are all students. And I'm also sending you the play script as part of this email package. So that's it. Thanks for listening to the tutorial and have a good week's writing.
Produced with Audacity and Martin Kevany Creative Writing. Music track Dortmund by Alexander Nakarada, SerpentSoundStudios.com. Please note this recording is for your personal use and should not be shared or published in any way. Martin Kevany Creative Writing 2020.